where, how far we got, who's got the notes? Thanks, Peggy. All right, Hebrews chapter 11, and we'll go from 23. In fact, I want to pick it up from verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, when she had received the spies with peace. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. And verse 20 speaks about Isaac blessing Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And you remember the incident when Jacob came in the name of his brother, and the blessing was given to the younger rather than the older one. And I think that we often hear the fact that Jacob deceived his father by appearing in his brother's name. And yet when you look closely at this passage, and as I was considering this passage today as I was sitting in Paris, it seems that he knew what he was doing. It seems that Isaac was not fooled by that whole thing, because it says by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning the things to come. So this verse seems to tell me, and in fact I can't accept that the father could not recognize the difference between the son's voices, even if there was nothing else. I'm pretty sure he knew who was before him. And this passage confirms that by faith he blessed them concerning the things to come. And remember that the blessing that he gave to Jacob the younger one was the blessing that God confirmed. And that was that God said that he loved Jacob and that he hated Esau. And so that's just very interesting in that verse. And then verse 21, it says, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of his sons, the sons of Joseph, and worshipped leaning on the top of his staff. And you remember what happened on that occasion. Exactly the same thing that happened with him, in that he, as the younger, received the blessing of the older. You remember that when Joseph's sons were brought to him, who were now his grandchildren, that he crossed over his hands, and his right hand was put on the younger one and his left hand on the older one. And you remember that Joseph tried to force the old man's hands apart, and he said, no, that's the way it has to be. And notice again that he says by faith. In other words, you can imagine how strong this must have, how hard this must have been for these men, because the tradition and the culture was that the blessing goes to the older one. And somehow God was speaking to him and saying to him, give the blessing to the younger one. And so he does that, but he does it by faith, not understanding what God had in mind and what God was doing in the future. Another important part of that verse is, and one can preach a whole message on that at the end of that verse, and we often just disregard it because it just seems to be a comment, and yet it is a very, very important comment. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. Why did he lean on his staff? Because he was crippled, because God had touched the thigh, and he was crippled, and so he needed the staff. And you remember, this was when he wrestled with the angel, and yet this is a very important thing, because it shows us here a man who was broken by God, a man who could no longer stand in his own self-sufficiency, but leans upon the staff. It's speaking about the fact that he was leaning upon God. And so we need to not lean to our own understanding, but we should be leaning on him. He is the staff of righteousness. And so he worships, leaning on the top of his staff. And by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instruction concerning his bones. And that was a powerful prophecy, speaking of 400 years in the future. It was 400 years from that time that Israel would during the Exodus be taken out of Egypt and be taken to the promised land. And here Joseph looks 400 years in the future, and he says, when you go home, you need to take my bones with me, with you. And you remember that that's exactly what he did. Now we come to Moses, and of course the two great heroes in this passage, or the two men that are used as prime examples of faith, is Abraham and Moses. And we've spoken about Abraham, and we now come to Moses. And it begins with his parents. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. Now you remember that the king was trying to limit the numbers of the Jewish children, and so gave an instruction that all the Hebrew boys were to be killed. And so the parents of Moses looked at this child and saw something about him. There was just something in their hearts that they knew that this child was special. That word beautiful there is really a very difficult word to understand, because it goes beyond just his physical features. And remember, you're talking about a little baby. And obviously all babies are cute to their own parents. And yet it's more than that. It wasn't just that it was a pretty baby, but there was something about this child that indicated that God had a plan and had a great purpose for him. And so they say they decided to go against the decision of the king. And remember, he was hidden, and his sister would stand afar off, and they made this little ark of bulrushes put tar or pitch in it and hid him there, and Pharaoh's daughter picked him up. But you can see it again, that of all the things that happened throughout the Old Testament, one of the things that is recorded here, and I'm sure that when the Holy Spirit inspired the writer to write this chapter, selected the most important events that really speak of great faith. And one would say, well, what about other people who did other great things? And yet here is this event which we seem to think, and I've never heard anyone preach about that, because it just seems to be so unimportant. But the scripture says the fact that his parents hid him was an act of faith. It wasn't just that they loved the child or that they had some selfish motive, but they knew that God had a plan for this child, and they hid the child, and it was an expression of faith. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. Now, verse 24, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches. By faith he forsook Egypt. Now, there's a whole lot of things here, and some of these things are not given to us in detail in the Old Testament. The first is that when he became of age, and I'm not sure when that would have been, in whether it would have been the Jewish culture of 12 or 13 years, or whether it would have been the Egyptian culture, I don't think that matters. But obviously the time came when he could stand and became of age. Some, in some countries it's 18 these days, and in other countries it's 21. But the time when he could make his own decisions, he said, I am not Pharaoh's daughter. I'm a Jew. That was quite a statement. Because in making that statement, he was immediately making it very hard for Pharaoh to promote him as a prince in the kingdom. Remember, because he was raised as a prince in the kingdom. And whether he could have become a Pharaoh, that we don't know. But certainly, it would have counted against him to identify himself as not being Pharaoh's daughter's child, but as being a Jew. And yet he does that by faith. That's the first step. Making that distinction of saying, I'm not one of them, but I am a Jew. And of course, that's the challenge for us as Christians, because so oftentimes we want to get along in life, we want to be promoted in the company or in the job, or we want our friends to accept us, and so we want to act as though we're one of them. Remember Peter, you're one of them. He says, no, I don't know him. And yet Moses, in distinction, said, no. He could have gone along with it and used the name of Pharaoh, or used the surname or the last name of Pharaoh, what that was given to him. And yet he chooses to say, no, I'm different. I'm one of the Jews. And I believe that that was the beginning of God's calling him and blessing him and using him in a powerful way that he did. If Moses had compromised on this issue, how would God have used him further? I don't know. I think it began there, and we know that Peter's downfall began when he was warming himself at the fire of the world instead of standing with his master. He's identifying with, and so you see that identifying who you identify with is very, very important. You remember the three young boys in Babylon, together with David, with Daniel, not willing to eat the food that was given to the other young men, the food that had been offered to the idols, making a distinction, saying, but we're different, and ending up in them having to stand, and they're in fact referred to also here in this passage as those who quenched the violence of fire, who were saved out of that fiery furnace, because they were willing to make a stand. They were willing to say, no, we are not them, we are different, we are Christians in modern language. And we are not of the world. And so that's where it began. Verse 24, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Now, that's a powerful decision that he had to make. He had the opportunity of continuing to just enjoy his privilege as a prince in the house of Pharaoh. He had everything that he could imagine. He had servants. He must have had a beautiful house to live in. He must have had a beautiful chariot. He had everything that you could desire. He could have any woman in the kingdom that he wanted. He could have whatever the food, whatever there was available in the world at that time was at his feet. Because this was, at this time, Egypt, remember, controlled the whole world. And so he was growing up in this incredibly privileged position. And yet he says, no, I don't want that. I want to suffer with God's people. That's a tremendous decision. And I don't know how many Christians would be able to make that kind of decision. And say, I'm prepared to say no to, and it wasn't like it was illegitimate for him to take this. It wasn't wrong for him to take it. It was there. He was raised in those conditions. He wasn't stealing something that wasn't his. It was available to him. And yet he says no to it. You know, that's very hard for us to say no to things that we feel is our right and our privilege. And yet Moses says, no, I don't want the pleasures of sin. The pleasures of that which is disobedience to God. And of course, I don't think when it speaks about the passing pleasures or the temporary pleasures of sin, that it's referring to adultery or drunkenness or those sorts of things. I believe that when it's speaking about the passing pleasures of sin, it's simply meaning that God's will was not for him to enjoy his privilege and his position and his status. And when God began to call him, if he continued to enjoy what Egypt had to offer, it would have been sin for him. That was the sin that was his temptation. I don't believe that God would have called him if he was a sinful man. When it speaks about, we've always got to remember, sin is not just those gross sins that we speak about. Sin is any form of disobedience. And when God calls you out of a situation, if you stay in that situation, it is sin. And for Moses to enjoy his privilege of his adopted family and of his adopted home, to continue to do that would have been sin after God had called him. And yet he says, no, I'm not going to enjoy that privilege and everything that is mine. I want to identify with the people of God. When he killed the Egyptian, do you think that he did that by mistake? Sometimes we get the impression that he just lost his temper and killed this man. No, I think he knew what he was doing. I think that he did it on purpose, because he was identifying not with the Egyptian, but he was identifying with a Jew. And he was saying, I will defend the people of God. I believe he knew what the consequences of that action would have been. And yet he chooses, and he makes a powerful decision. But he makes it by faith. Sorry. Then in verse 26, and I think I've spoken about this verse before, but a very, very important verse. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. The reproach of Christ. Now, again, many Christians read that and they say, well, they don't even think about it. And those who do think about it think, well, it must have been a misprint. That how can it refer to the reproach of Christ? Christ was thousands of years, 1500 years, still in the future. So how can Moses make a decision for the reproach of Christ versus Egypt if it was so far in the future? And yet I believe it's not a misprint. I believe that was his decision. When he said, I'm going to identify with the people of Israel, he was also saying, I'm going to identify with Jesus Christ. And when it speaks about his reproach, it's meaning the cross. Because Jesus was where his reproach was manifest. He wasn't reproached for most of his ministry. There were times when the Jews gave him a hard time, but for the 3.5 years of his ministry, that he was famous and people liked him and people followed him by the thousands. But when he was crucified, that was when he was reproached. And yet it says that Moses chooses to identify with the cross of Christ, with the reproach of Christ, rather than all of the treasures in Egypt. Now that's quite a choice. That's quite a career choice. And I just wonder how many Christians would be able to make that kind of choice. The cross, or living in the lap of luxury. Being raised in one of the wealthiest families in the world today. I don't know who, maybe the Hiltons. We don't want to speak about them. Or the Rockefellers, or the whatever, the wealthiest, who's the computer guy now? Gates. Bill Gates. Maybe living in Bill Gates's family and enjoying all of the power that comes with that. Or saying no to that and choosing the cross of Christ. Most of us don't have to make that choice. Some of us have to make the choice between a very average existence and the cross of Christ. And yet we find it hard to say no to an average existence for the sake of the cross. How would we make the decision between the position of being raised in the wealthiest home in the world and the cross of Christ, if we can't even say no to simple things and basic things in our lives? And I think that this man was indeed a great man. You know, there are very few people in the world who, when they are offered a position of power, will say no to that position of power. Some great promotion. And yet here's this man being offered the greatest position that the world probably has to offer. And he says, no, I want the cross of Christ. I want to identify with Jesus. And not identify with Jesus in his resurrection or in his glory, but I want to identify with Christ in his suffering. You know, that's quite something. And this is the problem in South Africa. I was speaking about the cross. And in fact, the article, I think, was in the bulletin this morning of Tozer about the old cross and the new. And this is the problem. Today, people want to identify with Jesus in his glory. They want to identify with him in his resurrection and his power and in his healing ability and his saving and blessing ability. But we don't want to identify with him in his shame and in his reproach and in the cross. And yet here's this man who did not even see Jesus, who did not have the record of the New Testament, who Jesus had not come yet. None of this had happened. But by faith in the future, he saw Jesus coming. And he says, I want to identify with that, rather than everything that he could see. Now, remember, this was one of the things we spoke about Moses, was that he was able to see afar off. And looking far into the future, thousands of years to Christ, and even more thousands of years to the New Jerusalem, he was convinced that those were the things that he wanted to identify with. And here is this, Moses also. And he looks into the future. And he could easily have been blinded by all of the pomp and the ceremony and circumstance and the glory and the gold and everything else that Egypt had to offer. But he looks beyond that. Can we see beyond the temporary things that so easily blind us, and that so easily cause us to become short-sighted and to establish ourselves in this world and look to the future? And so he looks into the future, 1500 years, and he chooses rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. In verse 26, and he esteemed, that word esteemed, he valued, he calculated the reproach of Christ to be greater riches. Now that's a powerful statement. In other words, he's saying than the treasures in Egypt. All of the treasures in Egypt. And we don't know how rich Egypt was at that time. Today, many of those treasures have been stolen by museums all over the world, and they spread all over the world. But many of those treasures are still intact. And it was just last year, you could go down in Wiltshire or somewhere, had the Tutankhamun exhibition, and you could see the some of these treasures. And you know, he looks at that, and he looks at the reproach of Christ. In other words, the lowest point in all of what Jesus is about. And he says the lowest point in Jesus is still greater than the greatest point that Egypt could achieve. In other words, if the lowest point of Jesus is still greater than the highest and the most wealthy that Egypt had to offer, how great is the highest point of Jesus? That's really the point. And Paul picks up the same thing. And he says that the wisest of men are foolish with God. And God's foolishness, in other words, when God is just messing around, not that he does, but when God is just joking, and when God's just the foolishness of God is still wiser than the highest thoughts that man can come up with. And Moses understood that, and of course Paul understood the same thing. And so he esteemed the reproach, verse 26, greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. He looked to the reward. There's the key to overcoming materialism, because that's part of what he's addressing here. To overcoming the pull of the world, the need for acceptance and popularity in the world, is to look to the reward. And he understood that there was a reward coming, and that was an eternal reward, What Egypt had to offer was temporal. Remember, it speaks here about the temporal pleasures of sin, or the passing pleasures of sin. Those were temporal, but the reward that the Lord will give is an eternal reward. And he understood and he saw that difference. And so, verse 27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. He forsook Egypt. Now, this is different to the people of Israel. Remember, they never forsook Egypt. God had to drag them out of Egypt. And even once he dragged them out, they still kept wanting to go back. And yet, right up to the promised land. Remember, when they got to the promised land and they had to cross over, they sent the spies. Remember their decision. They said, no, we're not going to go in. We must choose for ourselves men who can take us back to Egypt. So when God had done everything to get them just about there, they still want to keep going back. But Moses forsook Egypt. He turned his back on Egypt and he left. And that's a powerful statement of all of these people of Israel. Here's the one man who understood what Egypt was all about. And in fact, the amazing thing is that what they wanted to go back to was slavery. They never rejected the position that Moses had. Moses had the position as a prince in Pharaoh's house. And yet he willingly walks out. And yet the stupid Israelites want to go back to the slavery. Just like we often want to go back to the bondage of the world. And so he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Now there are two things that motivate us. Two main things that motivate us. The one is the positive things, and the other are the negative things. And we speak about the stick and the carrot. You know, if you want a burro to move, you hit it with a stick from the back, and if that doesn't work, or you help it on, you put a carrot in front. I'm sure we've seen the pictures of this with a carrot hanging in front of the donkey. So there are those two things. There's the reward, and there's the fear of the consequences. But it says concerning him that he did not fear the wrath of the king. Now many times we do things because we are afraid of what people will say or people will do to us. Sometimes there are people in power. Maybe our bosses or people in the government or whatever it is. Sometimes they are just people at our own level. Sometimes they are our friends. But there are so many things we do out of fear. Remember Peter, he denied Jesus, not because he was going to get anything out of it, just because he was afraid. Remember the Israelites, of all of them, bowed before that image of Nebuchadnezzar, except the three young men. Not because they got anything for it or were paid, but because they were afraid. And many times we do the wrong things because we're afraid. But it says that he did not fear the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. In other words, he says, there is someone else I need to fear who is greater than Pharaoh. And so if I'm going to be scared, let me rather be scared of God. Let me rather fear God than fear Pharaoh. And remember again, Paul picks up the same thought. And you remember he says, don't fear them who can kill a body. In terms of those who can imprison us and beat us up and torture us and punish us in a physical way. Don't fear those who can kill a body. Fear him who can cast both body and soul into hell. So if we are not motivated in a positive sense by the reward, because you see, he spoke about the reward. If we are not motivated by the reward that the Lord has to offer, well then let us be motivated by fear of him. There are those two things, because remember Paul speaks about that also, and he says some we need to save by fear, plucking them out of the fire. And so some people just somehow just move when they get a fright, when they have a reason to fear. And I suppose all of us have both of these qualities. And so when we want to be afraid of the world, when the things or the people around us want to pressurize us and we're afraid of what they will think or what they will say, let me rather see him who is invisible. Let me rather be concerned about what he's going to say than what people around me are going to say. Let me rather be concerned with what he thinks than with what people around me think. Let me rather be afraid of the censure and the judgment that he could place upon me than the judgment that people around me can place. And so he sees him who is invisible. That's the problem. You see, we go astray because we don't see the Lord. We think the Lord is not seeing us. We forget about him. And we do whatever we do. We make our decisions. But if we saw him, if we could see the Lord standing there every time we make a decision, every time we open our mouths, every time we do something, if we could physically see the Lord watching us, would we not act differently? I think we would. Not always. Peter, remember, he denied Jesus while Jesus was within earshot, and Jesus turned and looked at him. And that didn't stop him. But I think that we would live our lives a little bit different if we actually saw the Lord. And yet, is he not with us? Did he not say, I will never leave you nor forsake you? Does he not see everything? Does he not hear everything? Is he not present in every conversation that we have? So why do we say the things and do the things that we do? Because we don't see him. But Moses saw him. And Moses said, God is here. Let me act in a way that is in line with the fact that he is all-seeing, he is all-knowing, and nothing is hidden before his face. And so, seeing him who is invisible by faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Again, you remember the story. They had to put the blood on the doorpost. They had to eat the Passover. And those who did so were spared. The eldest in the family did not die. And many people, I'm sure, said, well, we don't believe this is going to work. And they didn't do it. And the eldest died. But by faith, Moses, and obviously most of the Jews, did this foolish thing. Which seemed to be, why do you want to do such a thing? They had not had any previous example of something like that happening. God just said, do it. And they did it. They did it because they trusted God, because they believed him. And because he did that, they were saved. And then verse 29, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. Now you remember the story. Now, I found that very interesting. Because what the Jews did and what the Egyptians did was the same thing. They tried to cross the Red Sea in the same place. And yet, the Jews were saved through that thing, through what they did, because they did it by faith. The Egyptians did the same thing, and they were drowned. So, what was the difference? Now, remember, we said when we began this whole thing about faith, is that faith has more to do with doing the will of God than performing miracles. And remember that Moses' parents hid him by faith. Moses did the things that he did by faith. Why? Because he was obedient to God. God told him to do so. And so, when God tells you to do something, and you do so by faith, his blessing will be on it. But you can do the same thing, and do it not because God called you to do it, but because you thought it was a good idea, and you're going to get into a lot of trouble. You see, because what the Egyptians did and the Jews did was exactly the same thing. There was no difference. But the one did it in obedience to God. The other did it because they thought it was a good idea. Because they were chasing the Israelites and they just wanted to kill them. And you know, there are many things that we do that may seem to be the right thing. It seems to be what everybody else is doing. But it wasn't what God asked you to do. And you do something without God's blessing, it's not by faith. And you will not have God's blessing on it. And so, you remember the people of Israel, the same thing. When they came to the promised land and they said, we want to go back to Egypt. And then Moses told them the trouble they were going to get into now. And then they said, no, let's go. Well, let's go. And some of them tried to go. Now, the previous day, God said go. And if they went at that point, they would have gone with his blessing. He would have opened the land for them, and everything would have been wonderful. But now, they go, but it's against the will of God. You see, so there are many, many examples of doing the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. But it's either at the command of God or it's not at His command. It's at His timing or it's not His timing. And when we do it out of our own selves, and even though that may be a good ambition and a good desire that we have to do whatever it is that we're doing, but because it is not what God has asked us to do, there is no blessing in it. And we wonder why there is no blessing, because we're doing the right thing. The Egyptians did exactly what the Jews did, but they were killed. The Jews were saved in that situation. All right. Let me just do one or two more verses. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Now, of course, the walls of Jericho didn't have faith. It looks like that when you read it, but the walls of Jericho fell down because Joshua had faith. And again, it was, you see, the idea that they had this great faith and they exercised this faith to these walls and made these walls somehow come down. Of course, there was nothing like it. All they did was simply do what God told them to do. So, and that seemed to be a stupid thing, to march around the city. I mean, what do you want to march around the city for? That, you know, that's never going to bring the walls down. And yet they had to do that 7 days, once a day, and then on the seventh day, seven times, sound the trumpets, and the walls came down. And sometimes we say, but what God is asking me to do just doesn't seem to be logical. It just doesn't seem to be what the situation calls for. Surely what we need to do is we need to build a ramp up against the wall of the city, or we need to bring a battering ram and break the gates down. We need to make some or build some catapults or do something else. But what God said is just march around the city. That takes faith. Just to do what God asks us to do. But you remember the whole thing about faith is it's not me who does the work. It's not my faith that does the work. It's God who does the work. All I have to do is line up with God. And when I line up with God and just in obedience do what He tells me to do, He takes care of the rest. And it's so easy. As Moses just struck the Red Sea opened up and God opened the way. Now you can go back and you can try and do that and you can try and pump the Red Sea dry and do whatever you like. It's never going to happen. But just do what God tells you to do. And so there are many, many things in our lives that are simple things. And we say, but you know, it doesn't make sense. But that's when faith comes. If you believe that God is asking you to do something, then do it. As simple as it may seem. And leave the rest to God. That is faith. It's not about me achieving something or doing something. It's about simply trusting Him, and He takes care of the rest. Amen.